Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today, I think we have a very important show, one I think is going to be a lot of fun and educational. And people actually should take notes because this is about your health and about how you take your control back. It's the mantra of the show to have personal responsibility, to be brave enough to learn what you don't know so that you can put your knowledge into action. I think we're living in times where if you don't protect yourself, you will be at the mercy of somebody who does not have your best interest at heart. So today I want to invite, or happy to invite, a colleague on who I respect greatly. He is somebody who lives in a way that he talks about, which I think is very authentic and organic. Today we're going to talk with Mr. Ben Fuchs. He's a natural pharmacist, a nutritionist, a cosmetic chemist, and he holds a BA in broadcast journalism from Syracuse University and a BS in pharmacy from the University of Colorado. He's practiced as a registered pharmaceutical and consulting nutritionist for well over 15 years. He writes a blog, he has news articles, and he also hosts a podcast called The Bright Side. It's a syndicated radio show on the GCN radio network. And that's how I actually first learned about him. I listened to his shows and I was just amazed. And it started me even more so down the path that I'm on, because you don't know what you don't know, and you have to be brave enough to admit that. And I think that's a sign of, I would say maturity, that you're always a student. And that's what I love about Mr. Fuchs. You have a show that you teach people, and it's positive. It's not negative. And that, I think that's what we need all to do so we can bring ourselves together. So welcome to the show today.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. George. That's such a beautiful introduction, and you really get what I'm trying to do. I love everything. And, you know, right back at you, by the way, we're cut from the same cloth in the sense that we both believe that health is a personal issue. It's about our personal responsibility. And unfortunately, many of us have not only abdicated our responsibility, but we've been encouraged to abdicate our responsibility for what I would say are nefarious purposes, both involving both control and money.
I think that you're absolutely right. And we're of a like mind. And I think everybody's being divided and conquered. And I think historically, people who practice allopathic medicine, you know, where you go to medical school and you do it by the book and all sorts of things, or it gets drummed into you. And we've been put at odds with our colleagues who are more natural and look at the body as a whole. We're all wanting, as I said, as I was on your show the other day, we all want the same things, but we've been, I think, educated into having territories, and you have to defend your territory, and Someone's encroaching on it. And if you take it from me, I won't have enough. I believe in abundance, and it's about patient care. Everybody's different and everybody's an individual, and it has to be done in a way that highlights that. So what works for one patient may not work for another. What one patient can hear, because it really is about a partnership in my office, for example. And if patients can't hear me and they've turned off, then I've lost them. I can't heal if we're not in partnership. And that's what I love about my natural colleagues, is that they think holistically about the patient. It's not voodoo. It's not something. It's physiology. It's biochemistry. It's really understanding things from a cellular level, isn't it?
Yeah. And even that's an awesome point, what you just said. And I want to get back to that, the idea of the cell, the nature of the cell, the nature of disease as cellular. We have a saying on the Bright Side, all disease is cell disease. I tell people often that there's no such thing as breast cancer when I want to freak them out and I want to kind of wake them up. I say, there's no such thing as breast cancer. There's no such thing as liver cancer. There's no such thing as pancreatic cancer. There's breast cell cancer. There's pancreatic cell cancer. Disease is cellular. And the reason we don't hear about it from the modern medical model is because there's nothing in the modern doctor's bag of tricks that can help the cell. Doctors can only eradicate the cell, drug the cell, ablate the cell, excise the cell, somehow electrocute the cell, radiate the cell. They can only damage the cell. They can only block the cell's biochemistry. There's nothing in the doctor's magical bag of tricks that can feed the cell. There's nothing a doctor has that can help improve the health of his cell. So consequently, we don't ever hear about the cell. We hear about the organ and we hear about the tissue. But at the end of the day, we are only as healthy as our cells are. And the good news is, this is such awesome news, a cell has been around for 3.5 billion years with a B. And in that 3.5 billion years, it has figured out what it needs. And it ain't medicine. It's not drugs. And it's not surgery. What it needs is nutrition. It needs oxygen. And it needs a clean place to do its work. And that's it. And the only thing that go wrong with a cell is starvation, suffocation, and toxification. Now, ultimately, once a cell breaks down, it leads to inflammation, which leads to, and this is microinflammation, not the kind of inflammation everybody thinks about, like a black eye, but microscopic inflammation around the level of the cell, which creates a blockade or a beaver's dam around that cell as a protective response, which ultimately, when it occurs chronically, when this kind of damage, cellular damage occurs chronically, leads to more starvation, suffocation, and toxification as nutrients can't get through this inflammatory blockade. Oxygen can't get through and toxins can't leave. And we end up with this downward spiral of starvation, suffocation, and toxification, leading to inflammation, leading to more starvation and suffocation, and toxification, and on and on and on. And this begins at a very early age. In fact, it may even begin in utero. For many people, it begins as, for many babies, it occurs as soon as the baby is born via problems that a mother will have with things like dysbiosis or wrong kinds of bacteria, not enough bacteria. And so from day one, we're undergoing this kind of cascade of inflammation, starvation, suffocation, inflammation. And by the time a kid is 20 or 30 or 40, you've got all these pockets of death inside this person's body. And it all starts at the level of the cell. And the good news is, Dr. George, is even though the medical model doesn't have any tools to address this, we don't need it. Nutrition is food. We get it from what we eat and from what we supplement. Oxygen is in the air. We breathe it. We respire it. And detoxification occurs through the lymphatic system. It occurs through movement. And of course, not putting toxins in the first place. So these are all things that we can do from the comfort of our own living rooms, comfort of our own kitchens, our bedrooms, our bathrooms. We don't need intervention if we understand the nexus of disease as being the cell. So when you talk about the cellular nature of all of this, of all of our medical or health travails, you're really hitting the nail on the head in terms of how we can address our own health without being intervened.
Man, you said a mouthful. That was such a great synopsis. And I'd like to see if my take on it is our body is self-healing if we get out of the way. Is that a way to see it?
Yes, absolutely. A cell has all kinds of mechanisms in there for repair. You know, cells are not, when we think of a cell, think of a cell, we see the circle on the blackboard in biology class, right? Mm-hmm. Or even in textbooks. That's not what a cell is. A cell is a blob. It's a little tiny microscopic blob. And within that blob, you have hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions occurring. A second, Dr. George. A second. How does that happen with this intelligence that is so tightly regulated and perfected that unless something is disturbed, it happens automatically on its own? And when a cell is poked, there are repair enzymes and chemicals that are immediately kick into gear to clean up that poke, to repair that poke, like a self-repairing tire. Mm-hmm. And this happens at the level of a cell with an intelligence that staggers the mind, that is incomprehensible and can only be something that is that inspires awe. We can't understand how this little blob can have the intelligence to create all of these different molecules and create different compartments and shapeshift and respond to the environment so exquisitely, but we can be in awe of it and we can support it. And that's my message as a healthcare professional is all of these things that are in our body that are occurring literally underneath our noses need to be respected, honored, and taken care of, nurtured.
I couldn't have said it better. And on that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Ben Fuchs. He's a pharmacist, a nutritionist, a chemist, and somebody who loves humanity. That's obvious to me. People can go to his website, pharmacistben.com. Before the break, Ben, we were talking about the big picture of cell health. You know, I'm like most I'm not like most physicians because we did at least a month of nutrition when I was in medical school. I don't know if my colleagues get that, but it wasn't enough. I mean, I'm learning so much now as a practicing doctor. It's amazing what I didn't know, and it's really coming full circle. I'm all in with what you said about the body being its own, it's its own temple. It's able to heal. It's able to recover. It's able to take all the insults that it experiences from what we breathe, what we're eating. So I want to go down to the microscopic, well, I should say the macro level. What do people need to do? What are the things that people need to be aware of? I know hydration is one, and making sure you get vitamins. Let's start off with vitamins. Well, should you get them from your food, or can you get them from artificial sources?
No, you can't. Here's the thing. I wish we lived in the Garden of Eden, where you could go pick a pear off a tree and get your vitamin C and get your fiber and get your magnesium and potassium and all the nutrients that are supposed to be in that pear, not to mention the trace and ultra trace nutrients. But those days are gone. Our soils are corrupted. Our farming techniques are tweaked. We use genetic modification to enhance the sweetness and decrease the phytonutrients. And there's all kinds of modern processing techniques that conspire to deprive us of the basic nutrition that should be in unprocessed whole foods. They're great, and they're still better than any. The bulk of your calories should come from unprocessed whole foods. But if you're counting on getting your micronutrients from them, that's a tall order. That's not going to happen. So supplementation is a necessary evil. I wish I didn't have to supplement, but it is a necessary evil. You have to make sure. It's like an insurance program, and it's not perfect, because the way micronutrients work is they're in balance with each other. They come in proportions and in ratios, and nature in its infinite wisdom has prepared foods to have the perfect proportion and the perfect balance of all the micronutrients. That's not going to happen when you supplement. Nonetheless, you have to do it, because that's the only way to assure that you're getting the basics. And on top of that, I have seen with my own eyes the kinds of recoveries that people make in terms of lowering blood pressure, losing weight, skin, especially the skin, especially improves when you start a micronutrient supplement program. Mm-hmm. So I've seen dramatic turnarounds, but it's not the perfect solution, but it's the only solution that we have is supplementation. Nonetheless, you still have to make sure that you're eating good whole processed foods, because there are phytonutrients that we don't know about that don't have a recommended daily amount and necessary an amount that we know that you need. So you can't really supplement with phytonutrients. There are probably all kinds of nutrients in plants that we don't even know exist that have hormetic value, where they stimulate biochemistry, maybe perhaps not completely nutritional value, but they may have hormesis types of effects, hormetic types of effects. They may have adaptogenic types of effects. And then there's also enzymes that are found in plant materials that we can't really duplicate supplementally. So you still have to get your bulkier calories from good, whole, clean, processed foods and good, whole, clean, unprocessed foods. But then you want to enhance it with supplementation. I came up with this concept I call the square of health. Well, first of all, after seeing a lot of patients in an individual way and also in a group setting, in group settings, I realize that there's three major points that underlie all health challenges, and all health challenges are built on top of these three fundamental points. I call these three points the triangle of disease. And the triangle of disease are the three points that underlie all chronic health issues. Point number one, the digestive system. Point number two, the blood sugar system. And point number three, what I call the adrenal thyroid complex, which is our stress management and metabolic system. And so what I found was when people have autoimmune problems, heart disease, cancer, neurological issues, all chronic long-term degenerative diseases, even though we try to treat these diseases, we don't do so successfully, because underneath those diseases, you have these three points: the digestive system, the blood sugar system, and then the adrenal thyroid system. And if you don't address these points, you're not going to be able to treat chronic disease effectively. But if you do address these points, you'll be able to treat all chronic diseases effectively. And so I came up with this concept of the triangle of disease. And as a way of balancing that, I came up with something I call the square of health. So there's three points that underlie all disease, and there's four points that you have to address if you want to be healthy. And the fourfold square of health is nutrition, respiration, movement, and rest. And so from a physical perspective, those are the four elements that need to be addressed if you're going to be healthy. Like there's three points of disease, there's four points of physical health. Now I say physical health because it's very important to me that we recognize, and I don't want to belabor this point, but I'm just going to say it because it's very important that people understand this is where I'm coming from, that health is multidimensional in the sense that it's not just physical. And I noticed that if I treated a patient or I recommended a a protocol for a patient who's very sick physically, I noticed that oftentimes they would improve, but they would plateau. Mm-hmm. And the reason they would plateau, I found, is because disease is multidimensional. It's not just physical. And by the time something shows up physically, there's usually three other dimensions that are involved. I call these four dimensions SMEP: spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. And I say, I'm not going to belabor this point, but I want it to be very clear that you can't address health issues strictly physically. You've got to understand the relationship between the emotions and the mental nature and the spiritual nature and how your body shows up, how the physical shows up. We know, and I know, you know this is very familiar to you, every time you think a thought and every time you feel a feeling or have an emotion, your body manifests biochemistry in the form of hormones. Mm-hmm. And hormones are linked to how we think and how we feel. And via that linkage, the physical body shows up. The physical body is the end result of hormonal effect, as a partially the end result of, or maybe even more than partially, maybe totally, the end result of hormonal mediators that are initiated by how we feel and how we think. And this is not airy-fairy. This is not some Boulder, Colorado hippie talk. This is hardcore biochemistry. It's so hardcore that when drug companies want to test a prescription, a new pharmaceutical, they have to filter out something called the placebo effect, because they know good and well that if the administrator of the test thinks, it doesn't have to be real. They just have to think something, they can affect the results via this placebo effect. So it has to be eliminated out via double blind and triple blind studies. That's how powerful this effect is. Now, leave aside the fact that maybe we should be, instead of filtering out the placebo effect, maybe we should be working with the placebo effect. Maybe we should be filtering out the pharmaceutical and using the placebo effect. Nonetheless, this is hardcore science, this placebo effect, the impact of the mind and the emotional nature to the body via hormones. And then there's the spiritual connection. And by that I mean, or a spiritual relationship to disease. And by that I mean the connection we feel with the universe, with reality. You know, when we're born, all of a sudden we see the world as being against us. It looks like there's the outside world and there's us. And from that point forward, we go through our life living in fear. You know, there's a lot of fears, there's a lot of phobias. If you go on the internet and you read about phobias, you'll see there's the fear of heights, and there's the fear of crowds, and there's the fear of public speaking, and there's the fear of peanut butter getting stuck on the roof of your mouth. No kidding, that's really a legitimate fear. There's the fear of spiders. You know, there's all these different fears. But really, despite the fact that there may be officially, according to the DSM and according to medical psychiatric diagnoses, there may be thousands of phobias, they call them fears, there's only one really, and that is the fear of the unknown. Everything boils down to we are scared of what we don't know. And to me, this idea of the unknown and the idea of the mystery of the unknown and the recoiling from the unknown, if you will, begins at a very early age. And with that, how that shows up physiologically is via the hormone cortisol. Essentially, the body is out of ease when it is experiencing a fear of the unknown. And this is manifested by the hormone cortisol. And when cortisol goes up, we know the immune system becomes suppressed, regeneration is impaired, tissue starts to degenerate, digestive system doesn't work correctly, the thyroid ultimately will become suppressed, the body becomes a mess under long-term chronic secretion of cortisol. And because we feel separated from the universe, we live our lives hypercortisolic. And this is why spirituality becomes important, because to me, spirituality is the idea that we're all connected, that we are one with the universe, that we don't have to worry as much as we're worried, even though our brains are evolutionary selective to have a survival bias, a negative bias. We're kind of hardwired to see the glass as half empty, because our ancestors were the ones who survived on the African savannah by seeing the glasses half empty, by seeing the world as a fearful place. So we have to learn to override that by feeling our connection to the universe, which is not just our connection to the universe is not just hypothetical. It's not just theoretical. It's real in the sense that we live in a unified field. We're all connected to each other. Every time I breathe out, somebody else breathes in. Right now, I'm breathing in atoms that the Buddha breathed out thousands of years ago. Everything is all one unit, even though our senses deceive us into seeing things as separate. And via this separation, we live our lives in fear. So, by the way, the meaning of the word sin is separation. And original sin is this original separation that happens as soon as we come out of the womb. And this shows up as the stress response, which involves cortisol, as I said, but it also involves a part of the body called the sympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system, as you know, is your fight or flight nervous system, and it's antagonized or balanced by the parasympathetic nervous system, which is your rest and digest nervous system. And this pitting of the sympathetic nervous system versus the parasympathetic nervous system is a primal dichotomy that is built in, is hardwired into our neurology, and it shows up as either joie de vivre or disease, as either ease or disease, as either health or lack of health. You can pick any kind of parallel or antagonistic metaphorical pairs that you want, but it comes out to good versus bad, light versus dark. In the Bible, Jesus says you're either with me or against me. And Christ to me represents the parasympathetic force, the love force, the healing force, and the liar, the adversary, if you will, is the sympathetic nervous system, which represents this idea that we're separate from the universe. So all of this is to say we have to understand our connection to the universe, and that's where the spiritual aspect of SMEP comes in. Mental and emotional, you have to think correctly, you have to be feeling things correctly. And this is kind of interesting because, you know, we're always told to love our neighbors, and it sounds kind of nice, and it sounds kind of cute, and we think that if we love our neighbors will be happy. But what we don't realize is when we think a crappy thought, it's our hormones that are changing. It's our cortisol that is going up. It's our fight or flight or stress response that is being amplified. When we love somebody, they don't feel the love. We feel the love. Isn't this ironic, Dr. George? When we love somebody, we're loving us. We're not loving anybody else. The love energy is in your biochemistry. So when we are mentally correct and emotionally correct, our bodies benefit. We're not doing it so we can be a good person. We're doing it so we can be whole and healthy. And then the fourth dimension, of course, is the physical dimension. And that's where the fourfold square of health comes in. And that's the nutrition, which has to come in through foods. And by the way, the less food you eat, the longer you'll live. The less calories you input in the body, the easier more resources your body has to do the good stuff. Digestion costs us nutrition. This is why people need a nap after they eat meals. along with quality calories, you also want to make sure that you're supplementing. And we can go into that in a moment. I'm happy to talk about my theories on supplementation. Mm-hmm. But then I want to just make sure people understand that there's the other three points, and that is the respiration. You know, you can go 40 days without food. You can go 4 or 5 days without water. But you can't go 4 minutes without oxygen, because oxygen drives all of the chemical reactions that everything else supports. So oxygen is the fundamental need for the body, and most of us are not breathing correctly. And part of that has to do with the stress response, because under conditions of stress, we tend to freeze, and that impairs respiration. And then we're not even taught how to breathe correctly. So breathing is extremely important. Breathing
exercise. Let's stop there, Ben. Let's pick that up after the break, because that's really important what you're saying. I don't want to cut you off. So let's take our second break. You're Living in the Solution.
You're listening to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George, consumer healthcare advocate.
Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Ben Fuchs, a visionary and somebody who people need to listen to. Go to his website, pharmacistben.com, and please listen to his podcast, The Bright Side. It's syndicated on GCN, and you have archive shows, correct? So people can go back in time and listen to what you've been saying.
Yes. And there's a search engine. You can punch in different topics and get the various shows that we talked about those topics.
Excellent.
And I call it the bright side, by the way, because I was so sick of all the negative news out there. To me, there's so much good news that we should be discussing, how wonderful and amazing our bodies are and our minds are and our ability to create whole cloth from whole cloth. Just pick ourselves by our bootstraps and via our imagination, create things that have never been created before. And so to me, the world is such a magnificent and beautiful place. But if you watch the noise, which is also known as the news, you would never know that.
No.
But we were talking before into break about this idea of respiration. Yeah. Respiration is one of the fastest ways to hack into this parasympathetic nervous system health and healing and rest and digest response. When the body breathes slow and deep and rhythmically, the parasympathetic nervous system is activated, alpha and theta brainwaves are activated, and you feel better. But you have to understand that those three points, it's the speed of the breath, you have to be breathing slowly, the depth of the breath, you want to be breathing into the diaphragm, you want to be activating the diaphragm, and it's the rhythm of the breath. The body loves rhythm. Rhythm is soothing to the body, and all of it is soothing. Slowness is soothing to the body. Depth is soothing to the body. It tells the body all is right in the world. But the opposite is really how most of us breathe. We breathe fast, we breathe shallow, and we don't breathe enough. So between the speed of the breath, the depth of the breath, and the rhythm of the breath, you have your main ways of activating the parasympathetic nervous system, the healing response. And you know, one of the best ways to assure that you're breathing correctly is to immerse yourself in hot water. You know, women intuitively know their bodies. They're so in touch with their bodies, women, because they have babies and they have a menstrual cycle. And so every month they're reminded they have a body. I always love when women are sad. It always strikes me as interesting when women are sad or when they have anxiety or when they're not feeling right. They'll always go take a bath. And I love that. It demonstrates to me how in touch women are with their bodies, because they know that in the bath, everything is right. And I always tell people, if they have high blood pressure, go take a bath. Because in the bathtub, you can't have high blood pressure. If you have a movement disorder, Parkinson's disease, take a bath. It's very difficult to have movement disorders in the bathtub. Because in the bathtub, you are completely immersed in water and you're reminded of the very last time when you were completely safe. And this is really what we want to – the key to health, the way I look at it, is the sense of safety. You know, Jesus says you have to be saved. We talked about how the Christ represents the parasympathetic nervous system, at least mm-hmm. the way I see it. Well, when Jesus says you have to be saved, he didn't mean that, it was a mistranslation. What he meant is you have to be safe. You have to be safe, which means you have to be parasympathetic. The body works best when it is safe. In the bath, we're reminded of the very last time we were completely safe. When was the very last time most human beings were completely safe? In the womb.
Yeah.
You know, so in the bathtub, your body thinks it's back in the womb. In fact, if you really get into a pinch, Dr. George, like us, God forbid something horrible happens, you know what you'll probably end up doing? You'll go into a fetal position, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. your body will intuitively want to go back to where it was last safe. And we find that if you go into the bathtub, all kinds of health benefits accrue. You feel relaxed in the bathtub. Your brain goes into an alpha state. If you have movement disorders, those relax, and you'll find yourself breathing naturally in the bathtub. In fact, if you know anybody who's on antihypertensives, or somebody comes in to your practice and they have high blood pressure, the best thing you could prescribe for them is a bath, is a hot tub, because their blood pressure will drop like a stone in the bathtub. So much so that when they get up, they sometimes feel dizzy. Because mm-hmm. their blood pressure drops so much. And if they're on an antihypertensive and they're in the bathtub, that could be a serious problem, because your blood pressure drops so significantly in the bathtub. What is the magic of the bathtub? The simple feeling of being immersed in warm water. What's that magic that drops your blood pressure faster and more healthfully than an antihypertensive? It's the magic of the body itself controlling the blood pressure and dropping it, reducing it, because it feels like it's not threatened. And that's what we want to start to understand, is that we have to be able to hack into our biochemistry so our bodies don't feel like we're under the sword of Damocles and it's about to drop on our heads. Mm-hmm. And that's what breathing allows you to do. When the body is breathed slowly, deeply, and rhythmically, it feels safe. And then the third point on the fourth, and by the way, the exhale is where the parasympathetic nervous system is activated, not the inhale. So you want to exhale more than you inhale. It's better to give than it is to receive. So you always want to exhale a little bit more than you inhale. And this is this last thing I want to say about the breath here. This is very obvious for patients who are constipated. A lot of patients, when they're constipated, they'll do exactly what they're not supposed to do, which is they'll breathe use something called the Valsalva maneuver, mm-hmm. which is where they don't breathe out, they just hold their breath and they push. and they can't get a bowel movement out. But if they focused on the exhale, everything would open up. You can experience this for yourself, anybody's listening. If you're constipated and you're trying to have a bowel movement, breathe out, focus on the out breath. Breathe shortly, a short breath in and a long breath out, and you'll feel everything opening up and expanding. But you can use this for any kind of relaxation type of response, even sighing, even going like, just like that. Even just fabricating a sigh will drop your blood pressure and activate your parasympathetic nervous system. These are all great hacks that you can use if you understand how the body works. And then there's the last two points on the square of health, which is movement and rest. The body needs to move, and health is directly proportional to how well the fluids in the body are circulating. Health is hemodynamic. It involves the movement of blood for a lot of reasons. First of all, blood delivers oxygen, blood delivers nutrients, and blood helps detoxify. Blood also generates an electrical charge called a zeta potential that drives the body as you're moving. And I said earlier how all disease is cell disease. Well, all cell disease is preceded by dirty blood. And blood stagnation is the common thread that runs through all health challenges. And improving the movement of blood is one of the fastest things you could do. And the lymph, which is, I should say, the movement of the circulatory system, which includes the blood and the lymph, is one of the fastest ways that you can feel better. And it's especially true if you're not feeling well. A lot of times when people aren't feeling well, they do exactly what they shouldn't be doing, which is not doing anything, sitting on the couch or not getting out of bed. When you don't feel like moving, shy of chronic pain or injury, or shy of acute pain or injury, when you don't feel like moving, that's when you want to get up and move, because you're going to be improving the movement of fluids, thereby improving nutrient and oxygen delivery, detoxification, as well as electrification. And then after movement, you want to make sure you're resting, relaxing, lightening up. This initiates all kinds of hormonal benefits that improve growth, repair, anti-aging, digestion. All the good stuff is maximized. The biochemistry of the good stuff is optimized and maximized when we are relaxed. And one of the all-time great strategies, Dr. George, all-time great strategies for health, for anybody who's dealing with any chronic long-term health challenges or just wants to feel better, even if they're not sick, is meditation. Mm-hmm. And I have personally had a meditation practice for almost 30 years. And I've yet to see a study that on meditation where they looked at health markers where the health markers did not improve when people started a meditation practice. And that includes blood pressure and cholesterol levels and blood fats and blood sugar and cortisol. I mean, every single marker you can name improves when a patient meditates. And meditation doesn't have to be anything airy-fairy or Buddhist or religious. There's a guy named Herbert Benson, who you probably heard of, who wrote a book called The Relaxation Response back in the 1970s, I believe. He was a Harvard physician, Harvard medical doctor, and he wrote a whole book on the importance. He didn't call it meditation because he was at Harvard and he couldn't call it meditation. So he just called it The Relaxation Response, and he had patients chanting the word one, O-N-E, instead of om, which would have probably got him kicked out of Harvard. He had him chanting one, one, and he describes all of the incredible benefits that his patients achieve in several books, but his main book is called The Relaxation Response.
I mean, there's so many awesome things that you just said, and my take home to that is you don't have to spend money. These are things that yes. you just do yourself.
Yes, yes, yes. At the comfort of your own home.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing, Dr. George? Just to sit with that for a second. You don't have to spend, not only do you not have to spend money, but if you add in calorie restriction and skipping meals, you'll actually make money. You'll actually save money with all of these health strategies.
Well, actually, in our next segment, I want to talk about the calorie restriction, and I guess it's the intermittent fasting, maybe? Is that with similar?
Well, they're both important. They're slightly different, but they're both important.
Okay. And I also want to come and talk about digestive enzymes. And for me, I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor, but I think the GI tract is probably one of the most important organs for everybody, whether
Absolutely.
You're in neurology, ortho, everybody. If you can't get the food and nutrients in, then you can't feed yourself. And if you can't eliminate it, then that's an issue too, isn't it?
Absolutely. 100%.
So let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with pharmacist Benjamin Fuchs. He is an awesome guy. I'm loving our conversation because I feel like I've come to a point in my life where I'm doing all the right things and I had to learn how to do it. But our show today is giving people a shortcut. So they don't have to learn by, you know, trial and error. They can start doing things now to change their quality of life. And this is not a political show, but I would say the first thing that people need to do is turn off the TV and the news because it's literally pushing you down the wrong path with all the negativity and cortisol levels going through the roof and blood pressure going through and hating on people that you don't even know. Just cut it off and now start concentrating on yourself. So before the break, Ben, we were talking about intermittent fasting versus calorie restriction.
Yeah.
Why is it important?
They're both, well, first of all, every study that's ever been done on calorie restriction shows that the less calories you eat, the longer you live. And there's very good reasons for that. First of all, the word calorie comes from the word calor, which means heat. And technically, a calorie is a unit of heat. So the more calories you're ingesting, the hotter your body is going to run. Just like a computer doesn't want to run hot, they have a little fan in your hard drive to keep your computer running hot. Your body doesn't want to run hot either. When body temperature rises, your body goes into a hypermetabolic state, and this involves enzymes, and enzymes start to work much faster. In fact, this is why we have fever, is so that the body can become hypermetabolic, and so the enzymes can work to get rid of the infectious agent. So keeping the body cool is one of the first benefits that you get from calorie restriction, literally calorie means heat. So heat restriction keeps the body cool. It allows it to run at a cooler temperature, and it allows it to conserve its enzymes. And this also occurs when you eat less food. You also conserve your enzymes because of the relationship between metabolic enzymes and digestive enzymes. The less enzymes you're expending in the digestive system, the more they're going to be available to do the good stuff. Not only that, but unfortunately, when we eat, eating costs us more nutrients. For most of us, eating costs us more nutrients than we're getting in our foods because our foods are highly processed. You know, the average American eats 80 to 85% processed foods. And some of these processed foods aren't even called processed foods anymore. They're called ultra processed foods, which means they have zero resemblance to food. And while a smattering of nutrients may be replaced, they're always based on the recommended daily allowance. And as I was saying earlier, just because you're getting your vitamins and your minerals doesn't mean you're getting all of the nutrients you need, because there's a lot of nutrients in foods that we don't even know exist that have essential or at least conditionally essential value. So eating costs us nutrients. Eating makes the body run hot. And eating requires a lot of work for the body. There's a lot of energy that the body has to expend to digest food. You know, 60-70% of your blood supply runs through your digestive system. So after you're eating, all of that blood that could be working in your brain and working in your muscles is now being rerouted to help process your food. This is why people feel more energy between meals if they don't eat a lot of food. It's also something called ketones that are produced when you don't eat. And this ketogenesis requires large spaces of no input of calories. The ketogenic diet, I'm sure you've heard of, is very misunderstood, at least by some people. If you ask the average person who knows a little bit about nutrition what the ketogenic diet is, they'll tell you it's a high-fat diet. If they know a little bit more about nutrition, they'll say it's a high-fat, low-carb diet. And if they know even a little more, they'll say it's a high-fat, low-carb, moderate protein diet. But what most people don't understand is the ketogenic diet that's only half of what a ketogenic diet is: low fat, a high fat, moderate protein, low carb. The second half, maybe the most important half of the ketogenic diet, is it's a very, very, very low calorie diet. The ketogenic diet was developed to mimic the biochemistry of fasting. At the turn of the 20th century, scientists became very fascinated with biochemistry. That's when really the study of biochemistry became really in vogue, and they wanted to figure out what it was about fasting that could control seizure disorders. They knew historically, they've known for centuries, that when you fasted, you could kind of slow down seizures or you could eliminate seizures. Even in the Bible, they talk about that, I think. And so they went to what was happening biochemically, and they discovered that when you fast, your body produces these really powerful energy bombs, molecular energy bombs called ketones. But they knew that people didn't really want to fast, so they tried to figure out a way to generate ketones that wouldn't require people to fast, and they came up with this fasting-mimicking diet, this is a diet that mimicked the biochemistry of fasting, and that's what the ketogenic diet is. So when you restrict your calories, you slow down the body's biochemistry, you conserve enzymes, and you conserve nutrients. But when you fast, you generate ketones. And the generation of ketones is incredibly valuable for weight loss, for appetite suppression, for energy, for muscle building, for neurological issues, even for cancer. The generation of ketones can be very valuable as a healing modality. So intermittent fasting is slightly different from calorie restriction, even though obviously when you fast, you're going to have less calories. But when you fast, the time between meals or the time between food, the ingestion of food, is a time when you're generating ketones, because those ketones are the byproduct of fat burning. And this is why I always tell people breakfast is the most important meal to skip, because the longer you can wait before your last meal on the previous day and your meal on the next day, the more you're going to be generating ketones. And so skipping breakfast, or if you can't skip breakfast, eating just a very small, densely nutriated piece of food, like a piece of fish perhaps, or sardines, or maybe an egg, is the best thing that you can do. You want to go as long a period without ingesting calories, or ingesting as little calories in that period as possible, so that you can generate ketones. And that's above and beyond the benefits of calorie restriction.
So that would mean that you're not the insulin resistance people who have that metabolic syndrome.
Yeah.
That would be the way to break that.
100%. 100%. Calories are insulinogenic. And the less calories you ingest, and the more nutriated calories, I call calories that have lots of nutrition with them, foods that contain calories with lots of nutrition, power foods. And the more of these power foods you can ingest, and the less of these empty foods that you ingest, the more likely you are going to be to improve all the markers of metabolic syndrome, which is the second point in the triangle of disease. You talked about, before we went to break, the importance of the digestive system, and that's the first point in the triangle of disease. The second point is the blood sugar system. And here's another thing, Dr. George, about the blood sugar system, is just because you have not been diagnosed as a diabetic does not mean you're not dealing with dysglycemia. And the nominalization of disease is really one of the great curses of the modern medical model. This idea that you get pronounced as having a disease or not having a disease, mm-hmm, based on a diagnosis. We miss the idea that if you have dysglycemia, if your blood sugar is constantly going up and down, if you're dysglycemic, that's bad. You don't need to be fully diabetic. You don't need to make that 120 milligrams per deciliter marker in order to be suffering from the problems of the high, what I call the high blood sugar, low blood sugar roller coaster, and insulin resistance. And you probably run into this a lot. You'll see a patient who's clearly dysglycemic. They're obese. They got high blood pressure. They got all the markers of metabolic syndrome. And they'll say, "Well, I had my blood sugar tested, and the doctor says my blood sugar is normal. My glucose is normal." And that may be well and good, but that doesn't mean that you're not suffering from dysglycemia. And all you got to do is look at a person's belly, or you got to just check their blood pressure, or check any of the markers of messed up blood sugar. And you can see, regardless of whether they've been pronounced a diabetic or not, doesn't mean that they're not suffering from the markers of messed up blood sugar. Dysglycemia is the problem, not diabetes.
You make a very good point, because we spend on the allopathic side, a lot of testing goes on and parameters which change based on what what is pronounced as normal all of a sudden. So cholesterol, for example, when I was in medical school, it was 250 was normal.
Right.
Now you've got to be put on medication to lower it.
180.
What's the effect? And I know there is one, of lowering your cholesterol too low.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And let me just say this real quickly. There's a distinction that we don't make between clinical chemistry and biochemistry. We are not clinical chemistry beings. We're biochemical beings. Clinical chemistry is the chemistry of the clinic. It's the chemistry of testing. And I don't really pay attention to the chemistry of testing. I want to look at my patient, and I want to hear my patient's symptoms, because my patient is not a statistic or an algorithm. And what most people don't realize is that test scores are based on reference ranges. And does anybody really have any idea how these reference ranges come up with these reference ranges? They're statistical algorithms, and they have nothing to do with individual patients. Statistics do not have anything to do with individuals. They're about large numbers and large groups. So just because somebody is high or low based on a reference range, if somebody has a blood cholesterol test or a blood sugar test or bone mineral density, whatever test they do, that doesn't mean that that's true about that specific patient. And to assume that because you are high or low in a reference range, that that is true about the individual patient who's being tested is a fallacy that doesn't serve the individual. And then secondly, about cholesterol, to me as a biochemist, I consider myself a biochemist more than anything else. And to me as a biochemist, there is nothing more important in the body than cholesterol. There's no molecule that is more valuable and more multifunctional and more important for health and for repair and growth than and anti-aging than cholesterol. Cholesterol is your building, stress management, good life molecule. And if you wanted to create a culture that was unhealthy and in physical as well as psychological misery, you could do very little things more functionally than lower than compel the entire culture to have low cholesterol. You would put statins in the water. Cholesterol is involved in healing. It's involved in growth. It's involved in repair. After surgery, your cholesterol goes up. If you're a bodybuilder, your cholesterol goes up. You probably know this. You probably heard this that they'll tell you estrogen comes from cholesterol. Testosterone mm-hmm. comes from cholesterol. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D comes from cholesterol. Cortisol comes from cholesterol. But it's more fundamental than that, Dr. George. Vitamin D is cholesterol. Estrogen is cholesterol. Testosterone is cholesterol. They don't come from cholesterol. They're modified versions of cholesterol. In biochemistry, mm-hmm. things are tweaked. They're just like they'll stick an oxygen here or hydroxyl group there. These are all versions of cholesterol. So when you take a drug that lowers your blood cholesterol, you might as well take a drug that's lowering your testosterone, that's lowering your estrogen, that's lowering your cortisol, that's lowering your vitamin D, that's lowering your progesterone, that's lowering your DHEA, and on and on and on. It is an unbelievable violation of the sanctity of the biochemistry of the body to exogenously manipulate or lower the body's ability to produce this molecule. And most of the cholesterol, by the way, in your body doesn't come from food. It comes from the enzymes in the liver. And so to artificially poison this system, the HMG-CoA reductase system, is so nasty and so anti-human being that it just makes the hair go up on the back of my head. By the way, cholesterol, the back of my neck, cholesterol, by the way, goes up when your blood sugar goes up. The higher your metabolism, the faster your metabolism, the more cholesterol you're going to make. And so diabetes and dysglycemia and elevated cholesterol go hand in hand. And that's a wonderful marker for dysglycemia, is high levels of cholesterol. So the best way to lower your cholesterol is work on the second point of the triangle of disease and use nutrients that help you lower your blood sugar. And it's no accident that chromium, which is involved in glucose control as a part of the glucose tolerance factor, also lowers your blood cholesterol. And niacin, which is part of the glucose tolerance factor, is just as powerful as a statin drug for lowering your blood cholesterol. The nutrients that help you lower your blood sugar and help you stabilize your blood sugar also lower your cholesterol because they're almost like equivalent biochemical phenomena.
Ben, I wish we had more time because you're just getting rolling and you have to come back so we can talk about how the medication is affecting the actual function of the body, because you just described something that affected all across the board. So in the seconds that we have left, how can people reach you and find your podcast or your radio show?
Okay, so through the miracle of the internet, I'm all over the place, and all you got to do is Google Pharmacist Ben, and you'll get page after page of videos and interviews and my blog and all kinds of stuff. If you go to my blog, it's pharmacistben.com. My radio show is called The Bright Side. It's on all the podcast platforms. If you Google Pharmacist Ben and The Bright Side, it'll just pop up on the internet. And then you can always shoot me an email at ben@ksco.com.
Thank you so much for joining me. I cannot wait to have you back on again.
Thank you, Dr. George. And by the way, Dr. George, all these wonderful things that you're saying about me, it takes one to know one. And right back at you, Dr. George.
Oh, you're sweetie. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.